This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. The National Institutes of Health director is telling Congress that AstraZeneca's suspension of its COVID-19 vaccine study shows there will be no compromise on safety in developing the shots. AstraZeneca has put on hold its late-stage studies in the U.S. and other countries while it investigates if a British volunteer's potentially unexplained illness is related to vaccination or a coincidence. NIH Chief Dr. Francis Collins pledged that science will be behind decisions of if and when any COVID-19 vaccine is good enough for widespread use. AstraZeneca's shot is one of three vaccines in late-stage testing in the United States. Teachers in at least three U.S. states have died after bouts with the coronavirus since the dawn of the new school year. A teachers' union leader worries that the return to in-person classes will have a deadly impact across the U.S. if proper precautions are not taken. Ashley DeMartinez was just 34 when she died Sunday. She taught social skills and special education in Missouri. A third-grade teacher died Monday in the state of South Carolina, and two other educators died recently in Mississippi. It's unclear how many teachers in the U.S. have become ill with the coronavirus since the new school year began. The world has hit yet another COVID-19 milestone, surpassing 900,000 deaths from the virus. The United States and Brazil together make up more than a third of those deaths. The number of infections is more than 27.7 globally. And again, teachers in at least three states have died after bouts with the coronavirus since the dawn of the new school year. A teachers' union leader worries that the return to in-person classes will have a deadly impact across the United States if precautions aren't taken. This is VOA News. Researchers at the Chinese University of Hong Kong now say that stool test may be more effective than respiratory test in identifying COVID-19 infections in children and infants since they carry a high viral load in their stool than adults. Stool samples may carry the virus even after it has cleared from a patient's respiratory tract, and that could lead to a better identification of asymptomatic cases, particularly in infants and others who have difficulty providing nasal or throat swabs. At least three people have died in a Northern California wildfire that has forced thousands from their homes. Butte County Sheriff Corey Honey announced Wednesday that two people had been found dead in one location and another person elsewhere. He didn't provide details, but California Highway Patrol Officer Ben Draper tells the Bay Area News Group that one person was found in a car and apparently had been trying to escape the flames. The fire northeast of San Francisco is threatening several communities. Stoked by high winds, it has burned a 25-mile path through mountainous terrain and parched foothills. Unprecedented wildfires in the U.S. state of Oregon have all but destroyed five small towns, and a record number of deaths is feared, according to Governor Kate Brown, as families began to report casualties. High winds and heat are stoking nearly 100 wildfires across the U.S. West Oregon is the worst hit state, as an area twice the size of New York City burns. Climate scientists blame global warming for extreme wet and dry seasons in the U.S. West that have caused grasses and shrubs to flourish and dry out, leaving abundant fuel for fires. The top U.S. general for the Middle East says the Trump administration will pull thousands of troops out of Iraq and Afghanistan by November. General Frank McKenzie says the number of troops in Iraq will drop this month from about 5,200 to 3,000, and he says troop levels in Afghanistan will shrink to 4,500 by November. The general made the comments during a visit to Iraq on Wednesday. Hundreds of police officers from Buenos Aires province defied calls to stop protesting Wednesday, stepping up their demands for a salary increase, better working conditions, and more protection amid the coronavirus pandemic. Wearing their uniforms, police officers took their demands to the president, Alberto Fernandez, official residence. They want a 56% wage increase to help support their families amid a crippling recession and strong inflation. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, September 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A second group of Burundi refugees are being repatriated from Rwanda today, Thursday.
All the formalities are in place. The logistic is ready to support these people to go back to their country, and the convoy will depart in the morning to cross the Burundian border early in the afternoon.
Rwanda's National Public Prosecution Authority receives the case against Paul Rusesabagina. Zimbabwe bans mining in national parks after an uproar over Chinese grants. Cameroon cattle ranchers say separatists are turning to cattle rustling. And Malawi's Minister of National Unity wants to meet with former President Peter Mutharika.
I think as a leader who is responsible for national unity and civic education, I need to engage every citizen of this country towards national unity.
Gambia's government offers COVID-19 bailout to the media. And a massive fire destroys Greece's biggest refugee camp. Those stories and more coming up on Daybreak Africa. The second group of Burundi refugees in Rwanda, numbering about 500, will be repatriated today, Thursday, from the Mahama refugee camp. The first group, which was repatriated last month, also numbered about 500. Rwanda is host to about 150,000 refugees, with about 48% of them from Burundi. Elise Vieux-Chalon is the External Relations Officer for UNHCR Rwanda. She says some of the refugees petitioned to return home following Burundi's peaceful election. Vieux-Chalon also said the returning refugees all passed their COVID-19 tests before being cleared to return.
We have around 500 people who have been going through pre-departure formalities. We will not have the final number until tomorrow morning. People were going to be in the pre-manifest of the convoy of tomorrow already went through medical screening, COVID test, but also documentation, etc. So all the formalities are in place. The logistic is ready to support these people to go back to their country, and the convoy will depart in the morning to cross the Burundian border early in the afternoon.
These numbers, the first and second returnees, this is small compared to the thousands that are still in Rwanda. But are you finding that more and more Burundi refugees are willing to return home?
It started with only the letter of 5 refugees, and only like a bit more than 1 month and a half after this letter was sent, we already have 4,000 refugees who signed up for return. So there is a genuine interest from some of the refugees to go back home. We have seen many people approaching us to get information on the repatriation process, because as we already mentioned, it doesn't have only to be a voluntary, but also an informed decision that they make for themselves. So UNHCR has opened a hotline and 2 registration centers in Mahama. Any Burundian refugee in Rwanda has the possibility to contact us to get information and also voice this willingness to go back home.
Have you been able to follow up with the first group of returnees in terms of how they are adjusting to life in Burundi?
Our team in Burundi is conducting what we call a returnee monitoring, protection monitoring. It means that they are visiting the locations where refugees are going back to check on their situation and see if any support can be given to them. But before going to the area of return, they spent 3 days in a transit center where they were provided with, you know, what we call a return package. It consists of a support in cash, a cash grant, which amounts to $70 per adult and also $35 per children. In addition to that, they receive 3 months of food rations. And they also receive a package of domestic items that will help them settle back in their area of return. So we have blanket, mattress, mosquito nets, etc., everything that can make their life more comfortable when they arrive in their area of return. And then once they are there, as I was saying, they will get visits from UNHCR. They have to approach the authorities to get back their civil documentation. They have access to public services services like any resident or citizen in Burundi. And they can also benefit from some community-based livelihood project.
Thank you so much, Elise. It's so nice to talk with you. Thank you again.
You're most welcome.
Elise Villachalon is the External Relations Officer for UNHCR Rwanda. She was speaking with us from the capital, Kigali. Rwanda's National Public Prosecution Authority on Wednesday took delivery of the case against Paul Rusesabagina from the Rwanda Investigation Bureau. Rusesabagina, the man portrayed in the Oscar-nominated movie Hotel Rwanda, was arrested last month for allegedly committing acts of terrorism, arson, kidnapping, and murder. In the movie, Rusesabagina, as a hotel manager, protected Tutsis during Rwanda's civil war. David Rugaza, one of Rusesabagina's lawyers, says Rusesabagina is in good spirit and that the authorities have allowed him to speak with his wife and children.
About the documents, I don't know what you mean by the documents, but what I mean is that the file has been submitted to the prosecution. That's where we are now, as per now, and we are still requesting if it can be released provisionally. That's what I can say as per now.
What can you tell us about his well-being? How is he doing generally?
Yeah, now he's doing well. He's good as per now. He's in good condition. The treatment was fair according to the law.
There's still a mystery in terms of how exactly he was arrested. Was he arrested inside Rwanda or was he arrested somewhere else?
About that, we haven't yet reached that point. I mean, in our conversation, we haven't yet reached that point.
Has he been able to speak to or talk with his family members?
Yes, he did yesterday, but when he tried to talk to the sister of his wife, since the phone of wife couldn't be accessible, but he managed to talk to the family because we requested so that he can talk to the family, and it was successful. He had some conversation with the wife and the kids yesterday.
David Urugasa is one of the lawyers for Paul Rusesabagina of Rwanda. He was speaking with us from the capital, Kigali. Malawi's Minister of Civic Education and National Unity says he wants to meet with former President Arthur Peter Mutharika in the spirit of national unity. As leader of the Malawi Human Rights Defenders Coalition, Timothy Mtambo led protests against alleged corruption in the Mutharika government as well as against the Malawi Elections Commission under Jane Ansah. Mtambo says the reconciliation meeting he is seeking does not mean that those who allegedly looted the country in the Mutharika government will not be held accountable. Former President Mutharika's spokesperson was not immediately available to comment. Mtambo says unifying Malawi is high on the agenda of President Lazarus Chakwera.
You know, our people have gone through a lot of pain. That's why they rose in millions to demand change. And indeed, change came and Mutharika regime is no longer in power. But the thing is, we cannot continue this way. We need to unify our people. And national unity, it's about justice. It's about fairness. And I think as a leader who is responsible for national unity and civic education, I need to engage every citizen of this country towards national unity. People have perceived that we are against the Mutharika, we are against the DPP, but we are not against personalities, but we are against what they were doing. You know, His Excellency the President, Dr. Lazarus Chakwera, has said we need to unify this country, and this is one of our key objectives. In his high-five agenda, he had unifying Malawi as one of the key issues, including those who disagree with our government, because this government belongs to everyone.
I'm not sure whether it were you or some other members of the cabinet who suggested that maybe it was time for people in the previous government to account for what they did. Now, these talks you want to have with the former president, does that mean you're willing to let bygones be bygones?
No. Actually, listen, you know, it's me. I've said accountability is a tenet of good governance. As we seek to unify, we must ensure that people are held accountable. Justice is justice, and justice means giving people what they deserve. If people deserve rewards, you have to reward them. If people deserve punishment, they must be punished. We are saying, much as we say we need to unify, it doesn't mean that we're going to suspend accountability. So when justice prevails, peace prevails, and unity prevails.
President Mutharika is an elder, but also he's a former president. Do you think is you who should initiate these meetings, or is President Chakwera?
Actually, I'm a servant of the leadership. As a minister, I can engage, because when I'm doing my job, I'm doing this job on behalf of the president. And look, it's not about the age. It's about the intent for the engagement. It's about what we need to do and what we need to achieve. So when I'm engaging Mutharika, I know he's an elderly, and I know that he's a former president. Then it means when I'm engaging him, it means the leadership, the president, has given me also the mandate to engage. It means this government is extending an engagement process to everyone.
Timothy Ntambo is Malawi's Minister of Civic Education and National Unity. You're speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, September 10th. Zimbabwe's conservation groups have welcomed a government ban announced Tuesday on all mining in the country's national parks. The government halted the mining after weeks of campaign calling for a stop to Chinese coal mining grants in Wange, Zimbabwe's largest national park. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
The Zimbabwe Environmental Law Association on Wednesday welcomed the government's decision to ban all mining in national parks. The group had filed an urgent request Monday at the Harare High Court, arguing that Chinese mining inside Wange National Park risked permanent damage to the ecology. Despite the apparent win, the association's Richard Ncube says they are going ahead with the court challenge.
The reason being that we still have a valid argument to make, as long as there are still valid authorizations that allows the mining company to continue mining in the national park. We still have a case to make, and we have to get an order before the court so as to stop the mining companies from mining.
The ban followed weeks of conservationist campaigns using the hashtag Save Wange National Park. The conservationists demanded the cancellation of the licenses given to Chinese companies to mine coal in Wange, the country's biggest national park. Minister of Mines Winston Chitando said the Zimbabwe Mining Development Corporation, ZMDC, was given permission before President Emmerson Mnangagwa came to power.
The mining concession was granted in 2015 to ZMDC, who have held that mining concession since then. They haven't done much work on the concession, and they proceeded to get a partner to undertake mining in the particular area.
The Zimbabwe Environmental Law Association cites Chitando and ZMDC as defendants in their high court petition against mining in Wange. It also names Zimbabwe's Environmental Management Agency and two Chinese mining companies. Conservationists fear that without a court order, Zimbabwe's government could grant the companies an exemption or easily rescind the blanket ban on mining in national parks. Simiso Mlevu is spokeswoman for the Center for Natural Resource Governance.
Wange National Park is a unique and important enclave because it is home to more than 45,000 elephants and all other animals which make up the Big Five. We don't think there is any tourist who would visit Zimbabwe to check on the production capacity of any mine. Tourists are attracted by wildlife. We hope government will genuinely stay by its word.
Tourism is one of the industries Zimbabwe hopes will revive the country's struggling economy. But China is also a major investor in Zimbabwe, which boasts that investment in coal mining will help it to become a net energy exporter by 2023. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Cameroon authorities say Anglophone separatists have stolen thousands of cattle from ethnic Mbororo ranchers since July, forcing them to move livestock hundreds of kilometers to more secure areas. Authorities say the rebels' cattle rustling appears to be motivated by food shortages. Moki Edwin Kizeka reports from the farming town of Bafia, Cameroon.
Forty-one-year-old Mororo rancher Sule Kela leads several hundred cattle to graze in the French-speaking village of Balamba in central Cameroon, near Bafia town. He says the cattle belong to five Mororo, an ethnic group of ranchers by tradition, located mainly in Cameroon's northwest region. But Kela says the Mororo are fleeing the English-speaking region because Anglophone rebels are stealing their cattle.
Areas like Wom, Boy Division, Boyo Division, Mezam Division, there's no place where they have not seized cows from the Mororos. And when the military, they go out for their work, you see them bringing cows that were seized from the Mororo community. And then most of the Mororos have carried their cows right to the western regions, central regions.
President of the Mororo Cultural and Development Association, Boskuda, Jaji Manu Gidadu, has also moved his 400 cattle to the town of Bafia. Gidado says rebels have stolen at least 3,000 cattle from Mororo ranchers since July. He says ranchers have relocated about 2,500 cattle to safer French-speaking towns like Bafia to escape the rebels.
Why they are the target group is because those guys met the Mororo people and asked them to join them to disturb the administration from functioning. And the Mororo people told them, no, we are here to rear our cattle and send our children to school.
Cameroon's livestock ministry says since the separatist conflict began in 2016, the rebels seized about 300 cows each year. Cameroon's military says the rebels seem to be stealing more cattle these days because of food insecurity and to sell across the border in Nigeria to fund their revolt. To crack down on the rebels, the military says it has reinforced control along the border with Nigeria. Felix Nje Ewumbe is the officer in charge of helping ranchers in the western town of Bafusam. He says host communities should support the ranchers and their families.
Nous les encadrons au quotidien, c'est-à-dire.
Ewumbe says the government gives them financial and moral support and informs them of opportunities in neighboring towns and villages where they can sell their farm produce. Separatists took up arms in 2017 to carve out an English-speaking state from French-speaking majority Cameroon. The United Nations says the fighting has cost more than 3,000 lives and forced 500,000 to flee to French-speaking regions or into neighboring Nigeria. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Bafia, Cameroon.
The Gambian government has allocated a $15 million C, about $300,000 economic bailout for the Gambian press. The government says the funds will help journalists during the COVID-19 economic meltdown. But as Pandero Umbaya reports from Raleigh, North Carolina, there is a growing concern over the government's financial gesture towards the press, as observers warn that independent journalism is likely going to be compromised.
Ibrahim Asilla is Gambia's information minister.
This effort to support the media, because we recognize the important role that the media has been playing. And that's why even if you look at our disclaimer that we have put there, you know, for the grant, support, we put a clear-cut disclaimer that this support is not given to suppress, views of the media on their reporting on COVID-19. It is not given to the media to cajole them to report on government activity, no.
Silla was speaking in an interview with the Fatu Network, a Gambian online television. Silla says it is normal for the media to be funded by taxpayers' money.
You need to understand how even the international media is funded. It's funded by taxpayers. For example, the BBC. The BBC is directly funded by the taxpayers. So as Radio Netherlands, so as Radio France International, so as the Russian international channels, VOA, and the rest.
But Gambia media analyst Dr. Omar Bad disagrees.
So the BBC, Deutsche Welle, Radio France International, or France 24, and then VOA, they use government money. But they are not hiding about that. They are not pretending to be independent media entities like what the situation we are looking for in the Gambia. That is the role of GRTS. He knows that. The only equivalent to BBC and Radio France International, or VOA, is the GRTS, Gambia Radio and Television Services.
But warns that any attempt on the Gambian media to accept funds from the government could jeopardize their credibility.
Well, I think it is a very dangerous trend in terms of the democratization process in the Gambia, because the media should be holding the government to account. If we have a situation where the media is being fed, spoon-fed in millions of dollarses from the government that they should be holding accountable, it is scary, and I don't think it's a good trend in strengthening our democracy in that country.
Sherif Bojang Jinio is the president of the Gambia Press Union.
The role of GPU is to make sure that so we don't control the funds, we wouldn't see money at all. GPU is not part of it. But then the core of every media outlet is its journalists. So these are members of the GPU. So we want to make sure that if this money is allocated and given to media owners, they will pay the journalists and they will look after the journalists who are our members.
Bojang says the economic bailout had been approved by the National Assembly. He says concerns raised by skeptics are well noted.
I can definitely understand those who are concerned that this will affect the independence and impartiality of the journalists, of the media, because this was something that's been discussed over and over. But as far as the media owners are concerned, as far as we know, the media owners, totally wanted this, and they asked for this. Now they have it, and they're all excited, I mean, even though the money is not yet here.
Bojang says two Gambian media houses have so far turned down the government's financial aid. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
A massive fire has razed Greece's biggest refugee camp, sending more than 12,500 asylum seekers to the streets of the island of Lesbos. No injuries have been reported, but the fire highlights the failure of successive governments to resolve overcrowded conditions at a rash of refugee camps on the front line of Greece's migration crisis. Anthony Karasava reports from Athens.
Firefighters battled the flames as thousands of migrants were evacuated from the sprawling camp of Moria in the early hours of Wednesday. Some suffered smoke injuries, and many of the 12,500 asylum seekers in the camp have yet to be accounted for. And that has the island's mayor, Stratis Kitelis, concerned. Most of them, he says, have huddled around a major motorway that leads into the island's capital of Mytilene. But many just fled the camp, running into open fields and surrounding buildings, he said, in search of safety. With the camp battling a COVID outbreak, officials are concerned that the security issue will grow into a health crisis, Kiteli says. The Moria camp was placed under quarantine last week after authorities confirmed that an asylum seeker had tested positive for the coronavirus. Since then, 35 cases have been detected, and more than 1,000 tests were due to be performed Wednesday alone. By some accounts, the fire broke out when refugees set dumpsters ablaze outside the camp to protest isolation measures. Witnesses said the refugees prevented the firefighters from intervening, allowing the blaze to race through the massive facility, destroying it. It is not the first time that Moria has been the scene of such violent protests. Initially built to house around 2,300 people, The camp has since had 12,500 people squeezed into its grounds, drawing repeated criticism from aid groups who condemn what they say are abysmal living conditions. Antika Rasava for VOA News, Athens.
And that's it for this Thursday, September 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ray Key Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.